Earl on the beat, Earl on the beat. So, Dr. Swick, do you think that the United States has hope with the current amount of debt that we are entangled in?
Yeah, we're hopeless.
We're hopeless.
Yeah, we're done. We're doomed. Just put a note on us. Put the pennies on our eyes. We're done.
Oh no! What do you think the deadline is? When do you think we'll meet our doom?
Oh, it was last Thursday. You didn't get the memo?
Last Thursday.
Yeah, last Thursday.
What happened last Thursday?
Well, you know, it was that's when the tags came in.
Oh no! Well. Yeah. I guess we'll see what's going to happen, but hello, all listeners. Welcome to What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. My name is Ethan Delves, and today I am joined by Dr. Paul Swick. Dr. Swick is here at the Letty Debate League Tournament as our content expert, and he has just given an excellent lecture on the national debt. But Dr. Swick is not only an economist, he's also a debate alumnus. With 3 years of high school debate, as well as 4 years of collegiate debate at Hillsdale College, today we'll be discussing how debate has shaped him as a scholar. So just for a little bit about Dr. Swick, Dr. Swick holds a PhD from Auburn University and is currently the BB&T Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Mount Olive. He regularly lectures at colleges and universities and also teaches at BB&T classes at colleges and universities, and he also teaches the BB&T classes on capitalism and free enterprise at North Carolina State University. He's a prolific author with several articles on the Foundation for Economic Education and serves on their faculty network. Dr. Swick, welcome to What's the Res.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time today to speak with
pleasure.
Us for our listeners. Okay, so Dr. Swick, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to want to do debate in the first place?
Well, I actually kind of stumbled into debate. I started off in forensics taking a public speaking class because I like to hear the sound of my own voice. And so they said, well, we should get you into competition. And then after a year of forensics, I did debate. And I got hooked because of the rigor, the clash. It appealed to me. And it was tremendous fun. And so once you get that bug, once you get hooked, you know, you're kind of set for life.
Right. Okay. So I know that you did 4 years of collegiate debate.
Yes.
With Hillsdale College, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How did you enjoy that? And how did Hillsdale College help shape you into the debater that you became?
Well, it was fantastic. I did really well. In my senior year, I was made All-American debater.
Wow.
And I was captain of the team for my junior year and my senior year. And we ranked nationally in those 2 years as well. The thing that debate does for a person is it helps them to think about an argument and strip out things like ad hominem attacks and appeal to emotion, and you're really looking at the logic of the arguments. But it's not just the logic of an argument. What you also have to do in debate is you have to take both sides.
Right.
And it's that taking of both sides that makes you look at an argument from these multiple perspectives, and these multiple perspectives is what allows you to really understand the argument.
Right.
And then once you're able to understand that topic and understand that argument, then you can figure out where you actually should be, right? Where you actually then come down. And then the other thing that debate did is that you have to listen to your opponent. You can't just assume what they're saying because they're making an argument. You have to listen to what they're saying and then internalize what they're saying and then respond to what they're saying, not just assume and demagogue what the other side is saying.
Right. Right. So, yeah, I would completely agree.
So debate is a very useful activity, and I encourage a lot of people to at least try it.
Okay. Yeah, I would completely agree with you. What styles of debate did you do for Hillsdale?
Well, we did team debate where we had affirmative and negative cases of 8 minutes, and then cross-examination, and then rebuttals. And then we also did some parliamentary style a little bit later on.
Okay.
That was sort of fun, the parliamentary stuff. It was brand new when we started, so it kind of shows
you
how old.
Oh, wow. I didn't know parliamentary was that new.
Well, it was new for us. We never did anything like
okay.
that. And so we went to Chicago to try it out, and we ended up we ended up taking second place. Never doing it before.
The first year.
Well, at that one tournament, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that's crazy. It was tremendous fun.
Okay. So were there any specific cases? Can you remember just one case that you really enjoyed, that you really liked working on, that still sticks with you to this day?
Well, there was a topic that we really enjoyed, which was resolved that violence is a justified response to political oppression.
Ooh, that's a good one.
And so other teams were saying, well, in South Africa, under apartheid, they're being oppressed, and so they should rise up. And then pick whatever country. Oh, these people are oppressed. And we said, this is a wrong approach, because you're just assuming that there is this implication. And so what we did, and I think we call it the Hillsdale approach, is we took the Declaration of Independence, where we said, you know, that government is designed to protect these rights, and when it violates these natural rights of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, then it is our right, our duty to rise up against the government, alter or abolish it, and then reconstitute another new government that does secure these rights.
I like that approach.
And that was a very winning approach. And you say, well, what's the negative side of that? How do you stop that, right? Well, what we did was we asked a question in cross-examination, which said, is there a time limit? Right? Is there does this have to happen by tomorrow, or is it just can continue on? And usually they'd say, oh, there's no time limit, and that was our trap.
Wow.
Because then you can say, well, if there's no time limit, then we can do Martin Luther King or Gandhi, and we can do peaceful civil disobedience until eventually they relinquish their control, their oppression. You know, so that was the most fun semester we had.
Okay. I like that point about the time limit. That seems quite in contrast to the resolution today for the negative arguing on the time limit for violence, because now the affirmative is arguing that the debt is running out of its time and that we're in trouble. So now the affirmative has to prove the burden of time limit as well. And I think that I would argue that mostly the negative does seem to have that burden of time limit, and putting a hard fist on the affirmative case saying why the affirmative is wrong and building their own negative case. But at the same time, I think that's a really interesting resolution that you got to debate, and I hope that someday I'll get to debate that one. I had a similar one about civil disobedience in a democracy, so not quite the exact same, but I also really enjoyed that resolution with that little twist on it. Looking back from your position as an academic and an economist today, how was debate formative for you, or was it formative for you? How has it shaped you as into what you are today?
Well, I think that it helps a lot with any sort of public speaking, because as a professor, you make a mistake on a marker board, you've got 40 sets of eyes or 100 sets of eyes or however many noticing every little mistake you ever do. So if you misspell a word, right, they all know. So you have to have a degree of confidence of getting up in front of people and saying something. And in debate, you lose sometimes, right? You don't always win. You make mistakes. You lose arguments and such. And it's that repetition of failure is a strong motivator to improve. But it also humbles you and it propels you forward. And then, as I said before, the ability to listen to what the other side said and then take what another perspective is into it. As an academic, you absolutely need to be thinking about these different questions from these multiple ways, because maybe you're not right.
Yeah, just maybe. A lot of people seem to have trouble accepting that these days.
Absolutely true.
Yeah, I think debate is really good at that too. I love seeing two sides of an argument, and I oftentimes find that when I see both sides of an argument, I find it really hard to take a stance on a lot of the resolutions that I've debated over the years, because I just see so many facts and so many values on each side. Sometimes it can be difficult, but I also really like your point about public speaking, because currently the number one fear in America is of public speaking above all else.
It's not one I've ever had.
Yeah, and I think it's a really special thing to use debate to help overcome that fear and to voice your ideas in society and bounce them off of other people so that we can be, you know, I would say proper and good citizens of society.
Speak clearly. You have to articulate. And how are we dressed today? Are we all slobs?
Oh, no. We're dressed formally in suits.
Right. And so it's a presentation. You are putting your best self forward, and you're making a pitch. And that can be in the boardroom. That can be a sales pitch. That could be to customers, right? And it's that sort of training that is invaluable.
So you see a universal application of the skills that debate has helped you build.
I would hope so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. So knowing that you did high school as well as collegiate debate, are there any differences between high school and college debate that you could point out for us, for debaters going into college hoping to continue their path of debate?
Well, back when I was in high school, we debated using sticks and stones and, you know, rubbing a couple sticks together to make fire. So it was a while ago. Debate has changed in its rules. There was a very, very predominant technique in high school, which was speed and spread, where you go as fast as you can. And I always reacted negatively to that. Not once have I ever found that skill to be useful in my actual life. And so when we went to Hillsdale, the coach, we were a small team, right? I mean, Hillsdale's only, at that time, it was 1,060 students, right? So it was pretty small. And so the team was, you know, not even 10 people. And so we mapped out a strategy of slowing it down and really making the argument the center of what we were doing. In fact, we decided that we would host our own tournament at Hillsdale. And when we did that, we didn't allow all of the formally trained judges and the coaches from the other schools to judge. We actually brought in attorneys from the surrounding area, and we said, you know, you sit down, you listen to what they're saying, and you make the decision. And then in the last couple of years, we brought that tournament, the final round, to downtown Hillsdale because it was the county seat. We had it in the old courthouse. We had a real judge sitting there as the judge, and then he would interrupt them in the middle of their speech. Wait, what are you saying there? Right?
Wow.
And that was an invaluable experience for all of the debaters there at Hillsdale, and they loved it.
I'm sure. That's definitely a lot different than I've seen in the types of debates.
I think we were unique on that one.
Yeah.
And we tried to be, and it was fun.
So in college debate, do you see as much spreading as you do in high school debate, or are things different once you get to college?
Well, in college, there were many different leagues, right? So there was NDT, and then there was a cross-examination debate association, and then there were a couple of others, and you would basically say, you know what, these guys are going too fast, we don't like them, we're going to form our own group, and so then we did, and then some of the others, we would grow, and then so some of the others would see that their pond was shrinking and evaporating, so they would then move over into ours, and then that would reintroduce the speed again, and then we would we got to splinter off yet again, right?
Right.
And so it was this evolutionary process. And I've not actually been in the collegiate debate world, since then. So I'm not exactly sure what the landscape is like today. But the core of making a good argument and speaking in a conversational tone and being persuasive with your logic and your facts and such, those are the key elements.
Right. So you would say that spreading almost deteriorates the educational aspect of debate and the formative aspect of debate when you ruin it.
I mean, there's probably an application of it if you're an attorney. It's like, well, you know, on the fourth subparagraph A, subsection C, they missed that point, and so therefore I win the argument. No. But
I've lost that way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. We all have. And then you learn how to lump and dump, right?
Right.
So it's a skill, but that's a skill where you can be attentive to detail.
Right.
Right. Okay. That's necessary. I understand that. But in terms of a much broader range of skills that you can use on a daily basis, not so much.
Okay. And I know that you've written for the FEE before, the Foundation for Economic Education.
Yep.
What topics do you like to write about? What are some of your favorite things to put on paper and send out?
Well, I like to think about the business cycle and the way that the economy is heading right now. That's one of my bigger topics. But more recently, I've been talking about the morality of economics, of what capitalism is in the free market. And I've had a lot of positive response of how to talk about economics to people so that they realize that the free market is a good and wonderful thing. It's a system that we have that, that encourages people to do their best, where we serve our fellow man, you know, strangers, and we not only benefit ourselves, but we benefit other people. And that's the sort of system that I think is more most beneficial to humanity. And so I've been doing a lot of writing and such on that as well. So, but what FEE is, the Foundation for Economic Education, and the other group, the Mises Institute, that I'm affiliated with, what we're trying to do is to remove some ignorance, right? Because people just don't know what economics is. So recently they came out with the Green New Deal, and it was like, oh yeah, I love the Green New Deal. Well, let's look at it, right? You want to get rid of 90% of the cars, you want to get rid of airplanes. Oh no, I don't want to do any of that. Well, they were ignorant, and you fill in some facts, right? Well, do you like capitalism? No, I hate capitalism. Oh, it's a whole bunch of greedy people. Oh, okay, well, let's think about it this way. Oh no, I like that. Well, that's because you didn't fill in the facts, right? So what these institutions are doing is that they're attempting to educate people in what free market economics really means.
Right.
And that's pretty important.
Well, how would you say that as individual debaters we could do a better job of, one, forming ourselves to be free thinkers and thinking about these things and being open-minded towards these sorts of ideas? How can we encourage other people to be as open-minded and just as these institutions are doing?
Well, there's a natural tendency with debaters to be open-minded just by the fact that they have to argue both the affirmative and the negative. Right. And in our lives, we can kind of sit on the fence and say, well, I'm kind of for this, I'm kind of against it. But when you're put in a negative position, you have to really defend that side as best you can, right? And if you're a lawyer, right, that's your job. I'm going to defend my client as best I can. Well, what this allows us to do, though, is not just for lawyers, but that's obviously the easy connection, but it allows me to see both sides of an argument. And maybe there's a third, you know, or fourth venue for this or, you know, direction on this argument, vector for this argument. And so we need to be constantly coming up with new arguments for the affirmative and for the negative, and that is by definition being open-minded by looking at it from all these different positions. And then the rules of debate allow us to be civil.
Right?
Because I can't just get up in the middle of your affirmative and just start yelling in your face or beating a drum in your face, right? I can't do that. That's not allowed. You have to sit, you have to listen. And if with your partner, you know, you can't communicate to your partner either, right? So you have to be patient and support your partner, but also let them do their thing, right? So you can't always jump in, right? So there's a degree of civility and patience that come into all of this. So there's a lot of wonderful things that come out of debate.
What would you say is the centerpiece or really the essence of debate as a communication exercise, as an educational formative skill? What is the centerpiece of this entire exercise that we're doing?
It's the ability, what you're trying to do is hone the ability to clearly articulate your argument, right? So it's partially logic, it's partially facts, and it's partially structure, but it's also partially your ability to speak in front of a group of people, clearly put forward your thoughts, and so it combines a lot of different skills, but the ability to clearly articulate your position is really important.
Okay, so kind of bouncing off of that idea, for all of our high school debaters that are here today and for all of the What's the Res listeners that we have out there, what advice, if you could offer any advice to these debaters, would you give to them as a high school and collegiate debater?
Well, first, I guess the first thing is you have to find the joy in it, right? You have to have fun doing it, because if someone's making you do it, it's no, and you don't have a passion, you're not going to get involved, right? So the first thing is that you have to find the joy in it, and if you're not enjoying it, don't quit. Find the joy in it,
right?
That's one thing.
Because there is joy.
I think there is.
I think so too.
But the thing is that you have to find it, maybe. If you know, it's like, I don't want to speak in front of people. Well, you have to overcome that, And don't think of it as a hugely negative thing, but then go out and find, you know, a passion in it. And then once you're able to do that, most of the other things will fall into place, right? Because then you'll find that you'll enjoy coming up with your arguments. You'll enjoy coming up with thinking about how what inflection points, what words would I have to emphasize to get this point across a little bit more, right? Or, oh, you know, that judge never heard that argument the way I thought I was presenting it. How can I present it a little bit more clearly, right? And all those sorts of things.
Right.
So if you find the joy in it, that will help propel and motivate you to be better.
I really like that argument because oftentimes Mr. Herring says that one of the biggest downfalls of humanity is accidental isolation. And as human beings, being creatures of communication, we strive and we desire communication with other human beings. And when we don't have that, our joy sort of diminishes and we aren't fulfilled completely. So I think I would completely agree with you there that debate fulfills our sense of a need for communication, a need with speaking with others, and even arguing peacefully and civilly, like you were talking about, mm-hmm. with other people. And I also know that both you and Mr. Herring went to Hillsdale College, so I wanted to ask one question, or I guess even more questions about Hillsdale, saying that it's really interesting, and I do agree with the entire Hillsdale approach to debate, eliminating spreading and going for the real key argument there. Mr. Herring has a regular habit of telling all of his students to at least apply to Hillsdale College. Would you agree with Mr. Herring?
Yeah.
Absolutely. All the way.
I mean, what am I going to say? Let's diminish my degree? No.
Right.
In seriousness, Hillsdale is not for everyone.
Okay.
It is a small school, and some people need large schools. Hmm. It is a school that is in a rural area. Now, it's grown since I was there, but it's a little isolated. And if you need to be in the middle of the action in a city, then it's not a place for you. But it was perfect for me. It was small. It was the size where you got to know all of your professors and they got to know you, where you're going through year after year with all the same people, and so you know all of your classmates and the people a year ahead of you and behind you. And that was the sort of atmosphere where we would debate with one another, even in the lunchroom. And, you know, people would say, well, why do you believe that, right?
Right.
And then I'd be thrown up against the wall, metaphorically, and say, yeah, why do I believe that? And it was challenging my priors. Hmm. And these are the sorts of places that you should be able to freely discuss and ideas openly. You know, there were no safe spaces back then. All of these sorts of challenges were great because they forced me to think through what I do believe,
right.
And why, and, okay. and go more deeply. And so Hillsdale's a small school, but it is a school that has a very long and ancient history. It goes back to 1844, and it graduated both blacks and women before the Civil War.
Hmm.
So it has a rich history, and it is one that's of a very proud tradition.
Wow, that's really cool. So if you could help sum up that idea a little bit, what kind of person is Hillsdale College for?
Well, Hillsdale College is for somebody who is interested in academics, in the world of ideas. It is a school where you want that sort of personal association. It is not a party school. It is not one of those where there's, you know, 20,000 other things there to distract you, because there really isn't. Hmm. And so you concentrate on your academics or your sports and your academics and those sorts of things. Now, I would be remiss not to put a plug in for my own school, which is the University of Mount Olive, which
right.
is in North Carolina, and we have about 1,000 students, and we're also a small rural school, so if you're looking for that sort of thing but a little bit closer, University of Mount Olive might be something that you might want to look at.
Awesome. Okay, well, I have thoroughly enjoyed this interview. This has been a fantastic interview. Dr. Swig, thank you very much for joining us on What's the Res.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too, Ethan.
All listeners, if you want to, if you have any questions or you want to email us, you can email us at whatstheres@gmail.com. That's whatstheres@gmail.com. Or you could follow us on Instagram at whatstheres_. We appreciate your kindness and candor, Dr. Schwick, and join us next time for more What's the Res?